From the Senate Committee on Rules for January 22, 2009. We have two items on the agenda. Both of those items are on the agenda for public hearings only, and we will not be going to work session on either item today. If I remind everyone to turn off their cell phones, because it's kind of a thing in committee rooms that cell phones can be very distracting. We're also dealing with another problem. The new PA system seems to react even if cell phones are even on silent, if there's any transmissions occurring, even if they are silent. Because we have so many people signed up for SB 61 and only two people signed up for SB 29, We have so many people signed up for SB 29 and only two signed up for 61, and 61 is by no means probably as, by no means will there be as much public interest in SB 61. I will go to SB 61 first. Mr. Estabrook, can you come forward? First of all, let me go to the committee administrator, and we'll just do a brief overview of 61.
Senate Bill 61 would add the Deputy Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to the list of public officials that are currently exempt from lobbyist registration and reporting requirements. There are a variety of other lobbying activities, and regulation of that conduct would apply to these officials. They're simply exempt from the registration and the reporting pieces.
Okay. Mr. Estabrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I appreciate this opportunity to testify. I am Bob Estabrook, the legislative and communications aide for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I've distributed some written testimony that discusses why we're seeking Senate Bill 61 and hope for your support of that bill. The very, very brief summary is basically we see two compelling reasons to add the Deputy Commissioner of the Bureau to the exemption in ORS 171-735. The first is quite simply that our Deputy Commissioner really doesn't lobby. There is only a very limited window in which his work leads him to exceed the 24-hour standard that is the usual standard for determining whether someone needs to register and file as a lobbyist. And the occasion when that occurs is typically right before a legislative session in response to legislators' requests about particular bill ideas that they may be pursuing. He occasionally gets involved in that and could potentially exceed the 24-hour standard. The other piece of that standard in ORS 171-735 sub 4 is the $100 of expenditures in lobbying in a particular quarter, which is something that he also does not do because Boley has no funds to spend on lobbying anyone for anything. The other particularly compelling reason that we see to add our deputy to this exemption is the majority of the other statewide officials' deputies are already exempted, and in fact there are several staff for the governor and the state treasurer who are what I would describe as sub-deputy level, who are also exempt from registering and filing expenditure reports as a lobbyist. Based on those factors, which, like I say, are covered in a little more depth in the testimony I've provided, we think that it makes sense to add the deputy commissioner to this exemption to put him on a similar footing to the other statewide elected officials' deputies, since he operates under a similar sort of appointed and under the authority of that statewide elected official situation. Really appreciate the opportunity to testify and would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Estabrook?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Do you have any idea why this hasn't been done in the past? Have they been reporting in the past, or they've just been not lobbying enough, or how's this been handled in the past?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, my understanding is that we have always complied with the requirements to have our deputy register and report. When Senate Bill 10 was enacted last session, several people were added to this exemption, some staff for the governor, the chief of staff for the state treasurer, which seems like it would have been a great time to have added our deputy. That didn't happen. Particulars about why that didn't happen, I have no idea and wouldn't comment on. But in our minds, it just sort of makes sense for our deputy to fit into the same category and eliminate the need to occasionally make sure we're registered and make sure that we have him file a report for a given quarter.
Any additional questions?
Well, I assume the Secretary of State, their deputy is exempt, and you say that this is kind of an anomaly.
Right. The list of folks who are exempted includes the deputies for all of the statewide officials except the Labor Commissioner and the Superintendent of Public Instruction. All of the constitutional statewide electeds have their deputies already included, and in some cases they have additional members of their staff who are also exempt.
Senator Metzger, any questions?
No, I don't.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Estabrook.
Thank you.
Bruce Bishop.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm appearing here not as a lobbyist, on my own behalf. Although I was registered as a lobbyist for about 21 years and served as president of the Capital Club in the 2006-2007 era when the Assembly passed Senate Bill 10. So I have some familiarity with government ethics and the laws that you've passed. Senate Bill 61 continues a longstanding policy of exempting principal legislative liaisons for elected statewide officials from the lobbyist registration and reporting requirements. I have no objection to that addition or to the bill specifically, but there are several issues that I think the bill raises that I'd like to present for the committee's consideration. As you proceed in discussing it. First of all, as Mr. Estabrook said, most of the statewide elected officials, deputies, are already exempt from these requirements. The Commissioner of Labor and Industries is not, nor is the Superintendent of Public Instruction. It seems to me if we are going to allow these officials to be exempt, we might as well be consistent about it, and I know of no policy rationale that the superintendent would not also be entitled to the same consideration. Second, the existing law exempts from the registration and reporting requirements staff and members of the Oregon Law Commission, but it's not clear, to me at least, the way the law is drafted, whether that exemption only applies when they are carrying out their law reform activities, or whether all members of the Oregon Law Commission and their staff are exempt from lobbyist registration and reporting requirements. There's a phrase that says, I think, members and staff of the Oregon Law Commission who carry out law reform activities, but the scope of that limitation is not clear. One of the reasons that could be an issue is that there are registered lobbyists who are on the Oregon Law Commission, and I don't know if they're exempt because they are members of the Law Commission from having to register and report or not. But as you have the bill in front of you, you might want to consider what the scope of the exemption is. My belief is that it was probably intended to exempt members and staff of the Law Commission when they're presenting their reports and their recommendations from the Law Commission. I'm just not sure that the drafting of that provision accomplishes that purpose. Third, there is an exception in the law for legislative officials having to register and report as lobbyists when they are acting in their official capacity. And, Mr. Chair, not only are you, of course, a legislative official, but your staff and your committee administrator and other legislative staff are legislative officials as well. But I'm raising a question about what the acting in their official capacity means. and what the effect of that limitation is. There is also a provision in current law that says legislative and executive officials may not be paid by other than the state of Oregon for lobbying. And I think there's a potential conflict here if, in fact, some legislative officials may be able to lobby if they're not in their official capacity. I'm not sure when that happens. I believe that you as elected officials are always elected officials, and you don't have an elected official hat that you can put on and take off. But as to your staff and other people, I don't know if this law, in effect, allows them to register to lobby or not. So there's, I think, at least a potential conflict there that's that could use some clarification so that people understood what their obligations are. Fourth, current law exempts members of the news media and specified state officials from the registration and reporting requirements as lobbyists, but their legislative advocacy may still constitute lobbying. They're exempt from being lobbyists and having to register and report, but when they advocate on legislative action, they are still lobbying. And that distinction between lobbyists and lobbying, I think, is very important in the law. One of the examples of that involves the revolving door that you enacted last session as part of Senate Bill 10. I know there's controversy about that issue, but it's my reading of the law that former legislative officials are prohibited from lobbying for one legislative session, even though they're exempt as lobbyists from the registration and reporting requirements. In my reading of the law, that's a pretty clear result. As I say, I know there's controversy about that, but I think that's an issue that this committee and this assembly can address and provide clear guidance to both public officials and others about what the law is. Finally, I just want to comment that I am appearing today not as a lobbyist. That's because I'm not spending 24 hours in a calendar quarter in this activity or any other similar activity in the building. I'm not spending $100 lobbying. And in addition, I am not providing personal services for compensation or representing any organization or interest as a lobbyist. All of my lobbying registrations terminated June 30th of last year. So I am appearing personally and not as a lobbyist. Finally, it's not really germane to the bill, but I wanted to point out that because of the way the law is drafted, and because I have no legislative or administrative interest in your actions, and legislative or administrative interest is a defined term in the law, but because of that, I'm also not subject to any restrictions on gifts or expenditures to legislative officials, and I have no intent to make such.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Bishop, and have always appreciated your very insightful comments, sometimes comma by comma, on pieces of legislation that gave us pause to spend lots of times on some things, but really do appreciate, in all sincerity, your real adherence to good legislative action, and I do appreciate that. I want to put that on the record.
You
brought up a couple of interesting points, and we're going to be dealing with this in other forms of this session. So while we have your expertise here, I'd like to bring a couple of those up. You pointed out the very interesting distinction in the statute between lobbyists and lobbying. And there's been a number of opinions and things that have written about that don't necessarily make that distinction. And that is that in the statute, or at least in some people's mind, that you're not a lobbyist if you don't have to register. And yet in the language, particularly Senate Bill 10 with former legislative officials, it talks about lobbying. It has nothing to do, you can lobby without being registered as a lobbyist. And because that purpose is defined differently than the qualification for a lobbyist. And I don't know how all that is, but I'm curious, have you ever worked under the rules in the state of Washington very extensively at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, I was registered in Washington State for a number of years.
Okay. Because their rules are a little bit different, and I was curious as to your interpretation here. Part of the things about lobbying in terms of who individuals are is trying to influence legislative action. And as I understand it, in the state of Washington, for example, right now in this bill we're talking about the deputy to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. But, for example, they're communications people. They're the people who write the press releases advocating positions on behalf of the departments that go to those of us in the Legislative Assembly and others that are often designed to push the legislative action of that agency. Under Washington, that is considered, if you're trying to influence that way on behalf of a private corporation or whatever, that was considering lobbying activity. That is not specifically specified here, but in the context of trying to influence legislation, how do you feel about those who are communicating on behalf of agencies for positions on behalf of those agencies? Is that something that should be considered lobbying because it is trying to influence legislative action?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, I think Washington's standards are substantially broader in terms of what they consider lobbying activity. Oregon has a narrow definition, and it requires legislative advocacy. It doesn't even include, for example, advocacy on administrative rules to an agency or advocacy, to a city or county government. Those activities are not, under the law, lobbying. The only lobbying that we consider in Oregon is advocacy on a legislative matter, either to a legislative or an executive official. So if I were advocating that the governor do something, make some recommendation, take some action involving the legislature, that would be lobbying. But advocating that the Department of Administrative Services or the Department of Human Services do something is not lobbying. I think Washington includes all of those activities in lobbying and has a substantially broader array of services that would support that activity being reportable as well. My recollection in part about the narrowness of our definition of lobbying stems from the fact, and I'm going to get this wrong, I can't remember if it was the 97 session, seems like it was about that time, when there was a report that the highest spending lobbying organization in the state was the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And that was because that agency reported every department official who touched anything having to do with the legislature. Anybody who picked up a bill, anybody who read, anybody who made a note, anybody who provided an analysis, they reported as lobbying. That was their interpretation of what the law required. Subsequent to that, the Attorney General was asked to reconsider and to direct state agencies about what constituted lobbying and came up with a rather narrow array of services that actually qualify. And so now lobbying is pretty focused in a state agency setting. Not everything involving the legislature needs to be reported as lobbying. It's only the advocacy for the budget or for legislation that gets picked up that way. So there are a range of options there. I guess what's determinative for me is, what do you want to know and why? Is it for the purpose of public disclosure that you want to see everything that supports a legislative advocacy program, or is there some other purpose in mind for the reporting and registration? I think Washington has a different philosophy. Ours is workable, I think, but it's substantially narrower.
Senator Metzger, are you complete?
I'd like to ask one more if I could.
Okay, if you could, and then I'm going to go to the final witness on this bill, and then we're going to go on to the next bill because we have 9 other people to testify on the next bill.
So. Absolutely fine. We'll throw this out, and Mr. Chair, thank you for the indulgence, and we'll be talking more about this, but I will just kind of put on the record as we talk about different aspects of this. In statute, lobbying means influencing or attempting to influence legislative action through oral or written communication with legislative officials, solicitation of executive officials, or other persons to influence or attempt to influence legislative action or attempting to obtain the goodwill of legislative officials. And the way I would read that is if I'm the communications person for the Secretary of State or the Bureau of Labor Industries and I am advocating to legislators to move such and such, or I'm advocating to the news people, then I'm soliciting other persons to influence. And to me, that would fit under that definition. And I won't say today whether I think that's correct or not, but just to point out, Mr. Chair, we have some very convoluted laws at the moment that are very gray in interpretation, and I think, and I hopefully we will address some of that clarity this session.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, if I can just respond, I think one thing you may find helpful in understanding what is legally required and what's considered lobbying would be to look at the Attorney General's opinion. It's an extensive opinion that discusses specific kinds of activities and determines what's lobbying and what is not lobbying.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Ted Hughes.
Mr. Chairman, I've changed my mind. Mr. Bishop has said more than I was going to say.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Hughes. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 61, open a public hearing on SB 29. Could the committee administrator please give an overview?
Senate Bill 29 will authorize local governmental jurisdictions to adopt an instant runoff voting system. It will require the Secretary of State to adopt rules governing the conduct of those elections, and it will provide local governments to bear the cost of any of those elections. And briefly, should I briefly describe instant runoff, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And the proponents, I'm sure, can explain it in better detail than I can. It's also called preference voting or ranked choice voting. But in the system, a voter can express a first, second, and additional choices. Then if no candidate receives a majority the first time around, the candidate with the fewest votes is eliminated, and then any voter who voted for that candidate as a first choice will have their vote transferred to their second choice. The votes are counted again, and the process is repeated until a candidate receives a majority.
Okay. I'm going to open the public hearing, which I've already done for this. We have 9 people to testify, one of them by telephone. And is that gentleman available now? Okay, and is this Mr. Geer?
Mr. Bogier.
Blair Bogier. Okay, Mr. Is it on? There we go. Mr. Bogier?
Yes.
This is Senator Devlin. I'm the chair of the committee. I'm here with the rest of the members of the Rules Committee. We are on SB 29, which is the instant runoff. This is the initial public hearing for this. It's a public hearing only. I'm going to ask parties to testify to limit their testimony to 3 minutes. That's so that I can actually get through the 9 people that are scheduled to testify and get the committee completed by its scheduled time to adjourn, which is about 11:40, 11:45. So please proceed. Identify yourself for the record, and basically you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Blair Bogier. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar for over 20 years. Until recently taught political science at Western Oregon University as an adjunct. And I'm currently working in San Francisco with the New America Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy institute where I specialize in voting
we'll
systems.
To tell them that.
I was here in San Francisco for the recent very successful instant runoff election. It's the latest in a series of instant runoff elections which San Francisco has used. The bill before you, Senate Bill 29, simply allows implementation at the local level of a 100-year-old provision in the Oregon Constitution. This bill does not affect statewide elections. It is permissive rather than mandatory. And I think it's important to see that there's no fiscal note involved with this whatsoever. This bill gives Oregon cities, counties, and metro the ability to avoid unnecessary and expensive two-round runoff elections. Instant runoff voting gives voters more meaningful choices, encourages positive, issue-oriented campaigns, and ensures that the will of the majority of voters is respected at the ballot box. Instant runoff, or variations of it, is used in Vermont, Michigan, Massachusetts, Maryland, Arkansas, Ireland, Australia, and in Pierce County, Washington, among other places. In Oregon, Reed, Lewis and Clark, and Lane Community Colleges use it for their student elections, and my children have used it at the Kings Valley Charter School in Philomath to select their projects for project days. Over the years, I've met with the elected officials in Corvallis, Ashland, Portland, and Eugene who want the option of using instant runoff voting for their communities. I believe that instant runoff is a superior voting method, but even if I didn't, I would support the right of municipalities in Oregon to decide this for themselves. This bill is really about local control. I think the committee might be interested to know that the voting equipment, the software, and the counting and auditing procedures all exist for instant runoff elections. However, those details, I believe, are best left for voters and elected officials to consider at the local level. And Senate Bill 29 simply gives them the option to do so. I'd like to conclude by saying that I'd be happy to be a resource for the committee as you consider this bill, and I urge you to send it to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I'd be happy to answer any questions now or in the future you might have. Okay. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for appearing here today by telephone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm going to go to two people at a time, Ken Tolinar and Judy Barnes, if you both could come forward. And again, please limit your testimony to 3 minutes, and then we'll see if there are any questions. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ken Tolinar, and I'm here representing an organization called IRV Lane County. This is a group of citizens who are interested in getting the Board of County Commissioners of Lane County to refer a charter amendment, hopefully next year, that would permit the Board of County Commissioners to call for instant runoff in elections involving county officials. The main purpose of Senate Bill 29 is simply to provide the statutory authority for cities and counties and metro to conduct IRV elections if they choose to do so. In 2001, the city of Eugene had a measure on the ballot that would have called for instant runoff voting. And at that time, the director of the state elections division was very active in his opposition to our measure. I should say that both Bob Cassidy, who's sitting here behind me, and I were members of that charter review committee. And we both became convinced that IRV would be a great addition to our county, our city charter. In any event, the elections division opposed our measure primarily, but perhaps not exclusively, because he said that there's no statutory authority, no express statutory authority for any local government to use instant runoff voting. Even though the Constitution, as Blair Bobbier said on the phone here a minute ago, even though our state constitution expressly permits preference voting, of which IRV is one form. I think that Senate Bill 29 could probably use some minor amendments. The main one, I think, would be to eliminate Section 4 of the bill entirely. Section 4 deals with how you conduct IRV elections. I would suggest that the place for those arguments to be made would be at the local level, as I think Blair also suggested. The issues around that Section 4 of the bill addresses, including the limitation of voter choice to not more than three, I think are issues that are again best decided locally. In summary, I would just like to reiterate that this is permissive legislation. It does not commit the state legislature to any kind of position with respect to instant runoff voting, either pro or con. It simply makes it possible to overcome the objections that have been raised by the Elections Division that we need specific statutory authority to allow local governments to experiment with IRV. And on behalf of the IRV Lane County Group that I'm here representing, we urge approval of this bill with the amendments which I have suggested.
Okay. Ms. Barnes.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, committee members. My name is Judith Barnes, and I currently serve as Vice Chair of the Election Integrity Caucus of the Democratic Party of Oregon, and as head of the work group within the caucus for instant runoff voting. Instant runoff voting is one of the legislative priority action items for our caucus. It comes directly from the 2008 Democratic Platform Convention. However, I'm not here today testifying on behalf of the caucus. You will be receiving official written testimony from the caucus later on, and I thank you for extending the period during which testimony can be submitted for another week. So I am here today testifying in support of SB 29 merely as an individual and a resident of Oregon and Portland. So thank you very much for your time. I won't take a lot of time to describe what instant runoff voting is and how it works because the administrator of the committee has done an excellent job, as well as people who have spoken before me. I just will refer you to the brochure that came with my testimony. A sample ballot appears as you open the brochure. And as an attachment to my testimony, the last page includes a flow chart explaining how the procedure works, if that's useful to you. I would like to reemphasize that SB 29 is permissive only. It has no fiscal impact at the state level, and it is a pilot by allowing city, county, and metro districts to choose to use instant runoff voting. You're merely allowing them to decide to do so if the voters want to. After this legislation takes effect, if it passes, additional steps would have to be taken before it would be used anywhere. Many cities would have to amend their charters, and some county commissions may have to put it to the voters. It will be implemented probably piecemeal, one jurisdiction at a time, but it doesn't mandate anything throughout the state. It merely is permissive. I'd like to also bring your attention to another attachment in my testimony, which gives a recent example of how instant runoff voting might have saved money for the city of Portland. This is where I live. There was a runoff election that was necessary for the Portland City Council seat that was contested in May. The runoff took place between Amanda Fritz and Charles Lewis during the primary. There was a 30-point difference between the two candidates, and no candidate received a majority of the votes. Therefore, the runoff was held. The runoff and related expenses cost the city of nearly $500,000. And if with instant runoff voting in place, that runoff would have been made unnecessary. Amanda Fritz, who had the lead in the primary, won the runoff election with 70% of the vote. So the outcome was not changed, but the expense would have been eliminated had we had that in effect in Portland. I'd also like to mention one other issue that may be of concern to committee members. I know you'll be hearing You'll be looking at legislation regarding the adoption of fusion voting at the state level this session. And I'd like to say that fusion voting and instant runoff voting are not incompatible. However, it would be a lot to ask, it's certainly a lot to ask the county clerks to implement two election reforms in the same election cycle, and I can certainly sympathize with that concern. And I would think it would be very, the county clerks or the directors of elections at our various local jurisdictions would certainly be within their rights to ask a city or county that was considering implementing this to not require them to make changes of those nature in the same election. The fact is it's very unlikely to occur because even if fusion passes this session, it becomes statewide. IRV only applies at the local level, and each jurisdiction will have to take the initiative to amend their charters or go through the process to actually implement it. We also then have to wait for the guidelines from the Secretary of State's office. And I would just conclude by saying although the Oregon Constitution has a provision for the use of instant runoff voting, what this legislation does that the Oregon Constitution doesn't do is direct the Secretary of State's office to come up with the guidelines for implementing instant runoff voting elections so that you don't have piecemeal applications and different applications by different jurisdictions, but all the jurisdictions will have uniform guidelines to follow. And I'd thank you for your time. And I'd like to urge you to favorably consider SB 29. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'll see if there are any questions. Oh. Keep in mind we still have six more people to actually hear from. So, yes.
I'll ask the question, Mr. Chair, for all of the folks that care to testify so they can incorporate that into their testimony. But if the Constitution says that all of these offices, for any offices, what's in Article 2, Section 16, why would we necessarily be interested in limiting this to county and local elections?
I think the question is basically why is the bill crafted in to limit this to an option for county and local elections, and why isn't the bill drafted to impact statewide elections? And
well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think that the feeling on the part of those of us who are supporting Senate Bill 29 is that it's a new idea to most people, and including, I'm sure, some members of the legislature. We feel that we'd like to show some successes at the local level. Cities, counties might be interested. There's nothing in the bill that requires local governments to institute instant runoff. It's completely optional. And so I think the feeling is that before we address the possible applicability of IRV to statewide offices or legislative offices, that we should have some experience at the local level in doing this. Believe me, there are many people in the email network that's been talking about the instant runoff for the past year or so who have different ideas as to the specifics of how you conduct an IRV election. That's why I have recommended that you just drop Section 4 of the bill completely and allow those arguments to take place where they belong, which is at the local level, rather than a burden on the state legislature in trying to decide whether you should have a maximum of three choices or allow as many as choices as there are candidates or whatever. There are lots of things that local governments could have certain preferences about. IRV is not a slam dunk. There are, you'll hear from county clerks, I'm sure, that there's concern about the administrative costs of conducting an IRV election. There's some pros and cons. There have been some legal objections to instant runoff, but I would like to call the committee's attention to the fact that in Minnesota last week there was a district court decision which considered all of the legal arguments and held completely in favor of instant runoff voting.
Mr. Tolinar, we're going to probably have to conclude, or I'm never going to get to the other six people.
Okay.
So thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, while the other panelists coming up, I just wonder if I was reading the history of the IRV in Washington State, and it appears that they had to have two ballots distributed because the really important elections, they didn't use IRV. They created a two-tier system. The statewide offices were traditional ballot, and apparently the other offices, county and maybe local, were IRV elections.
Yeah.
So they ended up having a parallel system. Anyway.
This is not meant as in any sense, as a negative, Senator Ferrioli, but some people would consider the local elections to be the important elections.
I agree. So the question is, if you don't pick your second choice in the local election, I guess you didn't vote.
Okay. Thank you very much. We will go on to Seth Woolley, Ethan Scarrow, and I'm going to go down to Pam Favre because she came from over 100 miles. Could those three people come forward, and could you please limit your testimony to 3 minutes each? Okay, I do not see a Pam yet. Is there? Well, there she is.
Chair, if I may, Ms. Favre sent her testimony ahead of time, so you have it in your packet.
Okay. I'll go first. And why don't we just start on your left and on my right?
Hi, my name is Ethan Scarl. I'm a computer scientist, recently retired from the aerospace industry, and had long-time interest in voting improvement methods. To speak to the spoiler effect, to address Senator Ferrioli's question, it's my understanding that there were legal rulings that indicated that more enabling legislation would be a good idea, if not required. And putting it into local elections is a way of gaining experience with the methodology without incurring statewide budgetary any burden. That's my understanding of the motivation there. Now, in this country, we're used to thinking of elections in terms of Republicans and Democrats as a two-party thing, and not worry very much about what happens if other people join in, because we don't think of them as having much of a chance, unless the election turns out to be close. This has changed a little bit recently, since the Florida 2000 election, when Ralph Nader was wrongly or rightly accused of being a spoiler in a very close race. And that has led to fear among voters that they may end up helping precisely the candidate that they like the least. If they vote for the person they really prefer, they will be not voting for their next best choice, and therefore helping the person they like less to beat their second choice. The best solution I know of to this problem is instant runoff voting. In IRV, a voter can be confident that they will not be helping the wrong person or the person they like the least, because their vote, if their first choice turns out not to be in a position to win, their vote will automatically transfer to their second choice. This is a nonpartisan proposition, and it will help let the outcome of an election reflect the will of the voters and not have unintended consequences, particularly in close elections. And by the way, I am also representing the Alliance for Democracy in Portland, and I do support the previous testimony, which suggests that that the technical details, such as how many choices the voters are offered, should be left to the local jurisdictions, although we do strongly support the adoption of SB 29 in either case. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and happy to answer any questions.
Okay. We'll go to all three and then we'll go to questions. Mr. Woolley.
Thank you, Chair. First, I'd like to mention something related to Senator Ferrioli's comment. I think what the bill is trying to do is, by allowing it to be implemented locally, that's putting the local level at the same level as the state legislature. The state legislature could decide to implement it, but it would have to take action the same as the local organization. So I think it's just a form of equality. It's not anything special. I would personally love to see IRV implemented in every single election. Just so you know. First, my name is Seth Woolley. I'm Secretary, Parliamentarian, Elections Administrator, and State Coordinating Committee member of the Pacific Green Party of Oregon, and here to obviously to speak in favor of Senate Bill 29. I'd like to thank my previous opponent in the Secretary of State race for pre-filing this bill, as well as my Senator Dingfelder for supporting this bill. You have heard and will hear lots of repeated arguments, so I'm going to try to be different. First, while the Democratic Party and the Green Party are both fully on board on their state convention platforms, I'd like to point out a few cases where conservatives could have used democracy rather than settled for minority elections to benefit. First, a recent U.S. Senate election in Oregon, the Constitution Party spoiled the election to the Democratic candidate, a candidate who also failed to win a majority in his own primary. Twice in a row, democracy lost. Second, the recent election in Minnesota with Franken and Coleman locked in a long battle over the very last vote. What the media didn't report heavily on was that the third-party candidate most likely decided the race, rendering the majority preference moot. It appears that democracy will lose again here thanks to throwing out the votes of all third-party and independent voters. Why recount the votes when you've trashed a significant amount of them? Third, Governor Kulongowski is in office thanks to a strong libertarian and my own party staying out of the race, throwing the fiscal conservative majority to a low-approval-rated machine Democrat. As much as I tried to recruit candidates, Jim Weaver backed out at the last minute due to the spoiler issues in that election. Shifting gears a bit, I'd like to mention that I've been told that there may be hesitance to tackle Fusion and IRV together in one election cycle. IRV is not only the least risky, since it has no impact on the budget, it saves money in the long run. More important in my mind is the effect of Fusion voting absent IRV implemented first. The big unions heavily back fusion voting because they can use it to manipulate minor parties through their existing organizational structures, most likely by showing up at sparsely populated nominating conventions and nominate major party candidates in the minor party, stealing the nomination from diverse minority and underrepresented voters and candidates. Implementing fusion before IRV compounds the spoiler issue by adding another hindrance to minority voices, creating incentive for co-option by powerful interests. However, fusion voting is overall more information in the long run. With IRV implemented first, minor parties will not be as incentivized to throw away their nominations to the meaningless status quo, bringing more new ideas. Those parties that do wish to use fusion thus will be able to more accurately represent their membership without the spoiler issue hanging over every nominating convention. Fusion first is a danger to third parties and minority voices. IRV is a strong benefit to competitive elections. Fusion second is the democratic way forward. Finally, the Green Party has used IRV and IRV-like election methods since its creation due to its strong democratic values and has had great success. The San Francisco Green Party was influential in getting IRV implemented there, and it has been a heavy lobbyer for better election methods overall. This is another idea the Green Party would love to have stolen by the major parties to ensure our democracy is majoritarian and not conflict-driven. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Vavra.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senators of the Committee, my name is Pam Vavra. I'm from Ashland, Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 29, which would expressly permit local jurisdictions to adopt instant runoff voting should they so choose. In the city of Ashland, we frequently have more than three and more candidates running for the same office, and it is very common for one to win the election with less than a majority of the vote. In the most recent election in November, for example, we had seven candidates running for mayor. In the year 2000, an Ashland city councilor was elected with less than 31% of the vote. And in 2004, one was elected with less than 36%. This means that in those two recent elections in Ashland, roughly two-thirds of the electorate voted for someone other than the winner. To many people in Ashland, including myself, this is a concern. We would like to impose a majority vote requirement, but we do not want to have the additional cost and other disadvantages associated with a separate two-runoff election system. IRV we find attractive because it would accomplish the majority requirement without those disadvantages. IRV eliminates the so-called spoiler candidate and the so-called wasted vote, as others have pointed out. In 2005, I helped to organize a group in Ashland called IRV Ashland, and we circulated an initiative petition to amend our Ashland City Charter to adopt instant runoff voting for city elections. We garnered more than 400 signatures in 10 days. A charter review committee that was impaneled at the time was considering other recommendations, and they placed a full new charter on the ballot. So we suspended our efforts until the conclusion of that. When it came time to resume, we decided instead that we would put our efforts into a state effort so that we could help pass enabling legislation such as SB 29 that would codify the process and rules by which IRV elections would be conducted. This way, more jurisdictions move toward instant runoff, we'll all be working with a consistent set of rules. I don't have any objection to those rules being established by the Secretary of State, by the way, if the committee chooses to amend the proposed legislation to that effect. Our representative in the House, Peter Buckley, has extended efforts toward this end, and of which you are hopefully aware. The House bill that he sponsored last session, HB 2761, emerged from House Elections and Rules Committee with a due pass recommendation. However, it was never heard on the floor. And associated with that effort, the Ashland City Council passed a resolution in support of House Bill 2761, and I submitted a copy to you of that resolution for your records. I am hopeful that the Council will be able to convey their support for this bill as well, but I'm not sure if time will permit that. But again, I appreciate this opportunity to be before you. I'm grateful to you for considering this bill.
Any questions for Mr. Woolley, Mr. Scarl, or Ms. Favre? Yes, Senator Ferriola.
I think there's some practical considerations that you brought in terms of the cost of elections and so forth, but I'm really going to be interested in hearing from the clerks. But it seems to me that the system that we have now provides the primary election process, and that may serve a different purpose than just the practical considerations of voting. In the primary, it's when people get an introduction to candidates, they hear from candidates, the candidates do a lot of outreach, sort of on a lower level, lower threshold of pain than they do in the generals. And it's a learning curve for candidates. And I guess what I'm hearing is that if you approve this sort of an approach, you're either compressing the election cycle or moving it, you know, putting all that energy into the one election rather than having two. Do you see any benefit to having the primary and the general runoff?
Yes, Ms. Babb.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, in Ashland, our city elections are nonpartisan, and so we don't use the primary system for that. Our primary systems are mainly used for the Democratic and Republican parties to advance their chosen nominees.
Okay. I just want to say thank you very much for driving all the way up from Ashland. Thank you for coming.
Appreciate it. Thank you all. Thank you very much. I'm going to go to the, I believe there are two here, although one is in very small print underneath, the county clerks, Georgette Brown and Jan Coleman.
Here.
Out. Representing the county clerks, I should say. It's not all of the county clerks that I don't have space for.
We have quite a few county clerks here.
Sheriff, I mean, Ms. Coleman sent ahead as the material Senator Ferrioli referred to about Pierce County are in your packets.
I've seen that.
Okay. 97, and again, if you could identify yourself for the record and please limit your testimony to 3 minutes each.
I'm Georgette Brown. I'm a former county clerk, but I'm now representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Okay, and today I come to speak against Senate Bill 29. As was mentioned earlier by the attorney, the Pierce County voters did experience this type of voting. In November 2006, 53% of the voters of Pierce County, Washington approved Charter Amendment Number 3, instant runoff voting. And this method, as was mentioned, is also ranked choice voting or preference voting. Pierce County held its first ranked choice voting election in November 2008. Pierce County voters answered a questionnaire included with their ballots asking if they liked the new ranked choice voting method. The results were yes, 32%, no, 63%, and undecided 5%. So the Pierce County voters really didn't like the process very much at all. Key issues to consider with instant runoff voting. Financially hard-pressed counties, again, there is a fiscal impact on counties. Financially hard-pressed counties would be mandated to pay for hardware and software costs out of their general fund. Additionally, new software would require both federal and state certification, and we've been informed that this would take about 4 years. Our current systems do not have instant runoff voting in them. If an IRV election was allowed to be included with a traditional election, this would require a second ballot. Two ballot pages increase postage costs, both to the county mailing out and to the voters returning them. There would also be added printing costs, added staffing costs, and delays in attaining results. Voters would have to be encouraged to return both ballots. In the past, when we've sent out two ballots, as was the case in the November 2000 election, a lot of people did not return both ballots. And this caused the problem for our election boards trying to balance how many ballots came in for each precinct, and it took a long time. Voters would need to be educated on how to vote the IRV ballots. Now, in the bill, it says if no candidate receives a majority of the first-choice votes, the candidate receiving the fewest first-choice votes is eliminated. Each vote cast for any eliminated candidate shall be transferred to the candidate who was the elector's next choice on the ballot. Candidates with the fewest votes shall continue to be eliminated, with the votes for those candidates transferred to the candidate who was the elector's next choice on the ballot until a candidate receives a majority of the votes cast. This is all well and good, but transferring votes from one candidate to another raises a flag of distrust, in my opinion, when people think that the elected officials are transferring votes from one candidate to another. Transparency in the voting process is being called for more and more today. People want to understand the election process. Simple and straightforward is the best way. I don't see what's wrong with the way we traditionally vote. The person with the most candidate wins. Okay. So thank you. And if you have any questions, but Jan is here to talk also.
Okay. I'm Jan Coleman, Yamhill County Elections. Also representing the Association of County Clerks. I don't have a lot to add to what Georgette said. You do have some materials that I sent and that were prepared in depth by the Lane County Clerk and give you a lot of information. Our big concern here are two things, is the integrity of the election and the cost to the counties. And right now, counties are fiscally impaired. So if it costs $2 million in Pierce County to bring IRV about, I hate to see what it's going to cost statewide for each county. Sequoia voting system does have software for this. However, it's run on different machines. We run Central Count Vote because of vote by mail in Oregon. These are precinct counters. And so in order to have the software installed on our Central Counts, in Lane County alone, the estimate is $750,000. And as Georgette said, we'd have to get it certified. It can take up to 4 years.
Any questions? Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Georgette and Jan, for your testimony. I am perplexed by one thing. This piece of legislation doesn't require anything. It just says that the people you represent, in your case, Yamhill County, can choose, the citizens can choose to do this. And if this were available and citizens of Yamhill County came to their county commission and they said, this is what, you know, we'd like to consider, this is how much it's going to cost, this is what it's going to do, regardless of any of the issues you brought up, why shouldn't the citizens of Yamhill County decide whether they want to do that or not? Why should we just say, no, you don't get to have that discussion, you don't have an opportunity?
Well,
we'll start with you, either one of you. I mean, no one's telling you to do anything else. It's saying you have an opportunity to have that discussion if that's what you want to do, to elect your officials, and you have the information within your political subdivision. Why shouldn't they have a chance to do that?
Okay, well, because to begin with, the county clerks are the ones that actually conduct the election, and they have to have the equipment and the software. So before any of the entities can ask for it, the equipment has to be bought. The software has to be bought and this is thousands and thousands of dollars counties have to spend.
I understand, ma'am. I'm just saying, though, that you would be making that case to your commissioners and telling them that, and then you would make a decision.
I know that my commissioners would not be willing to pay for it.
Okay. Well, then they would probably reject it then, but at least yes. They should have the opportunities. I'm saying, part of the thing is we're trying to do, I think, in elections is to have more inclusiveness and more tools available for the public to see how they want to govern. And that's my only point. This is a tool. It's not a requirement. And your advocacy may be very persuasive and accurate, but it should be done among the people in which you serve, as opposed to saying, well, the legislature just doesn't allow us to have that discussion.
Senator Devlin, may
yes.
I respond? Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, one thing you do need to realize is the counties do have to conduct the elections for the cities also. Mm-hmm. And so if the city chose to do that, then we'd still have to implement the software and so forth at our own cost. The city is not going to get charged for the software.
And conversely, along those same lines, even though they're the issue of local control and you would have to comply with state law and federal law in terms of the accuracy of your vote counts and in terms of all the things that you would have to do to make sure that they were absolutely accurate.
Correct.
Okay.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Metzger.
I'm done. Thank you.
Senator Farioli, then Senator Burdick, and then I still have two more people.
Ms. Vavra testified earlier that in Ashland there was an effort to bring a petition to require the preference voting, and I assume that that petition was relying on the constitutional Article 1, Section 16. So it's already legal. It's just a matter of the jurisdiction. And so I wonder if we could have somebody explain what is the technicality that needs to be fixed.
In Jackson County, they have the same system that Josephine County has and that most of the counties in Oregon have. It's the ES&S system, and that system is not capable of doing this kind of voting right now. So this is where the problem is. The counties would have to get the additional software, hardware, and it takes 4 years to certify it.
Mr. Chairman, I get that part.
Okay.
but my question has more to do with why are we having, what is the specific technicality that SB 29 is designed to fix? Because what I heard earlier was that a jurisdiction's already petitioned to have the issue put on the ballot, and if they had chosen to go forward with their election process and it was successful, that's the voting system we'd have in Ashland. So if it's already in the Constitution and folks are already out with petitions to get that done at the local level, what is the problem that we're here to fix?
We'd have to take people in order. So if either of the parties here could identify that issue, and we can get clarification.
Okay.
We can get clarification on that issue at a later date.
I might even believe him if I could find out what is the clarification.
Okay.
Senator Ferrioli, are you finished?
Thank you.
Senator Burdick,
and then I'll go to two final people. Yeah, this is, I have the same frustration that Senator Metzger has. I mean, you're talking about the logistics and the cost when what this bill is about, it's about a policy issue. Is it, are we going to get better election? Are we going to get elections with more integrity if we have this type of system? And, you know, if that's important to the local voters to have this as a policy matter, then it seems to me that, you know, steps need to be taken to make sure that it's supportable and it's accountable. I mean, if obviously the local government, if they spend money on this, they're not going to have that money to spend on something else. And so that, but that, to me, to have that be a local decision would really put you, if that's the way it was done, what would that matter to you? Because if you had the money to do it, why would you mind doing it?
If I had the money, if the county clerks had the money to do it, that would be fine. At this point, they don't. If the cities could conduct their own elections and not have the county clerks conduct the election for them and get their own equipment, that would be a different story.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I wanted to follow up on that one point because this is something I don't know about how the process works. For example, the city of Portland did a city council election that was referred to earlier, and they happen to have public financing. So are you saying that the city contributed nothing to paying for that election?
No, I'm saying probably the city paid for the current expenses, the staffing, the hours that was spent, but they didn't pay for the hardware, the software, the election equipment that actually conducts the election.
Well, supposing there were something in some protection in there that if the city voted to do this, that they would have to bungle up for the cost of making the software transition.
Oh, I wouldn't object to that.
Okay. Because in fact, Mr. Chair, in Portland, the point was raised in this one particular council race where the margin was terrifically wide, and yet the taxpayers were on the hook for another, probably $300,000 to have a general election, when in fact, some of that money could have gone to supporting an instant runoff instead, and I think the overall savings would have been greater.
Okay. Senator Burdick, have you concluded?
I'm done.
Okay, Senator Atkinson.
Just to build on Jenny's, not a question but a comment. Senator Burdick makes the point, so if just to reiterate, if the city of Eugene voted to have an IRV and under this law as we have it before us, citizens in Springfield then would probably end up having to pay for it because they're all under the same elections in Lane County. But if the city of Eugene elected to have IRV, and you had an amendment, like you've just said, that said if they elect to have it, they pay for it, so it doesn't cost the surrounding citizens who don't elect to do that no money, then you do have what Senator Metzger was talking about. It doesn't cost the counties anything. Is that?
Yeah.
Do I understand that provision correctly? Is that right?
I think what we would clarify, I think that would be accurate if it was all possible. And if they would pay the full cost of that, we don't have any testimony, nor am I planning to get any today, on whether there would be any cost incurred to the state. But I don't know that today.
Well, if the state would like to pay for the equipment.
Yes. but anyway, but I do think, Senator Atkinson, your question is right on target in terms of, if it's on the issue of if an individual jurisdiction wants to make the choice to do this, is willing to pay the full cost of doing this, should they have the right to do this? Basically, is what it gets down to.
But right now, a city could say to do it, of Ashland could say, we want to do this, and citizens in Medford would theoretically be paying for it.
Correct.
Theoretically.
Chair Devlin, Senator Atkinson, yes, to some extent, they do not pay for the equipment to do the counting and the software to do the counting. The cost of the election doesn't put that in there.
Hmm.
when we figure the cost of the election.
Okay. Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you both for coming here today. I'm going to go to our final two people. I hope I don't mispronounce this terribly, but it looks like an N to me. Fillard Ryan and John Gere. And if you could please limit yourself each to 2 to 3 minutes, we'll be able to conclude at least within about 6 minutes. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Gere. I'm an attorney here in Oregon representing myself here today as a civic-minded person. I want to start by responding to Senator Farioli's question about why just local? If this is a good idea, why not go for everything? Well, those of us who have studied voting systems for a long time might be delighted to have a better system used for all elections, but I think we could concede that there's the unfamiliarity for many people and the transition. Any transition, there's a friction, there's a cost, there's an adjustment, and people are much happier when they choose to have change rather than have change imposed on them. This permissive bill simply allows local jurisdictions to have the kind of good discussion that we need to be having about is it worth the price, particularly with voter-owned elections. Eliminating the primary is a huge deal. It's a big savings for candidates. It's a big savings for the municipalities. That goes to your second question about primaries. You know, does this truncate primaries? Does this get rid of the primary? And don't we get something from primaries? Well, actually, the loss of candidates too soon is one of the reasons that I support instant runoff voting so much. I've been a resident of a number of cities, and what I find is that we lose candidates through the primary system too early, before voters have tuned in. They might not have the name recognition, but they have good ideas. What the primary does is it forces them out and gets it down to a zero-sum, winner-take-all, two-person race too soon. And so you've lost some of the ideas, and you also lose voter interest. Voter interest is connected to the number of viable candidates. With instant runoff voting, you have viable candidates right up to the major high turnout election. So you get a greater diversity of views represented. You get more voter interest, more people campaigning. You eliminate any accusations about, well, you're just a spoiler to help the other side. And the voters don't have to worry about their vote backfiring on them. I mean, I can vote for the Constitution Party candidate without having to worry, am I going to elect Jeff Merkley? You know, I don't have to worry about that. And that's a big deal. Does it have a cost? Well, you know, transition costs. I mean, you guys are in government. You know that anything good tends to cost money. Nothing's free. And if there's a better voting system, will it cost money to transition? You bet. There'll be a cost. There will be savings over time, but the money is not the issue. The issue is, should the people of Metro, should the people of Salem, should the people of Ashland be able to have that discussion, weigh those costs, and decide, is the benefit obtained worth the price? I think it is. Others may object, and we can have that discussion, and that's what democracy is about. I think the question about Pierce County experience, very important that you view that in the context of a very bitter and long-running fight, including Supreme Court case on the top two or Cajun primary in Washington State. The Pierce County experience has to be understood in the context of that bitter fight over the top two primary that Washington is having. And a lot of the anger at IRV is people who are frustrated that they didn't get the top two, the Cajun primary that Washington put in place. So it's not a directly relevant experience. I'll close with that and to say, please do send this on with a due pass, and I'd love to answer any of your questions.
Okay. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, good morning. My name is Fillard Ryan. I'm from Portland. I support Senate Bill 29, and to keep this short, I'm going to confine myself to one point regarding the spoiler effect in today's elections. As you know, Senate Bill 29, it's a permissive bill. It's about local elections, local choices. However, I want to use real-life illustrations that you're all very familiar with. So let's take a look at some past elections for governor and president. So we've got Clinton, Bush, Perot over here, Roberts, Frontmeyer, Mobley, Bush, Gore, Nader, and Kulongoski, Saxton, Westland. Now, I'm going to hazard a guess that every one of you cared, perhaps deeply, about the spoiler effect in at least one of these four races. And so did other people, right? I mean, lots of discussions, lots of arguments, lots of media attention. So if you think back to the amount of time and personal energy that people spent arguing about the spoiler issue and whether a person should indeed vote for the candidate of their choice or not. Now, please imagine that all the time and energy that people wasted over this bug in the system were instead directed toward real issues, okay, problem solving, or at the very least, relatively good-natured discussions over the merits of candidates and who would actually perform better if they were elected. That's one of the benefits this bill will allow, is to get rid of this huge waste of time so we can focus on real issues. Thank you. May I briefly respond to some of the questions that have been asked?
Yes.
Okay. First thing, with regard to, is instant runoff already legal for local jurisdictions? Some people say yes, some people say no. And so if we don't get this bill, what happens is that if a local jurisdiction does try to implement instant runoff, there could be a big court battle. In the meantime, people who think that instant runoff is not legal at the local level say so, and they don't necessarily admit to any ambiguity. So that leads to a lot of confusion in the discussion of whether to implement instant runoff or not. So that's a big reason to have this bill, even though it is potentially unnecessary, just because of that ambiguity and disagreement. Quickly, just to note, with regard to things like the two ballot pages and other logistical things like that, a lot of that has to do with what technology is available at the time and the choices that are made at the local level. An instant runoff ballot might require a separate ballot page, or it might not, and the answer might be different right now than it is 10 years from now. So getting this law in place, you know, enables local jurisdictions to make decisions whether it's now or in the future. Thank you.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
I will be closing the public hearing at this time, but to remind everyone, we will still accept public or written testimony for another week. This bill may come back at some time in the future for another public hearing or work session, just like any of the other bills. I do believe that if it hasn't been dropped yet, there may be a similar bill already in the House. The business of this committee is concluded for today, except for to let you know that we get notice to you as soon as possible about meetings for next Tuesday and Thursday. We will not be meeting this Friday, and just so that we'll get that to you as soon as possible.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My first choice is that it's already legal. My second choice is to vote no. So you figure it out.
Okay. With that, we are adjourned.
I need you to sign everybody today. We can do it tomorrow morning. The introduction.
But I'm not actually the sponsor.
No, we put the.